Founders, welcome back to the Zero to 5,000 podcast, where we obsess over the convergence of human potential and business results. Today, our hosts Drew McClure and Jordan Mitchell have another insightful conversation for you. So let's jump right in.
All right, founders, welcome back. Today, I'm joined by the co-founder and CEO of Promenade, Farbod Sharaka. Farbod co-founded Promenade along with his partner, Greg Weistein, in January of 2021. With a strong passion for building products that make the lives of small businesses better, Farbod drives the vision and strategy for Promenade. Before co-founding Promenade, Farbod co-founded and was the CEO of Bloom Nation for 9 years. We are pumped to have such a creative and entrepreneurial-minded guest. So Farbod, welcome to the podcast, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so we just mentioned this briefly before we started recording, but the company Promenade is actually somewhat of an extension of that earlier business. Is that correct?
Yeah, we started Bloom Nation about 10 years ago. And as we've been developing the software for local florists, it was during the pandemic that we decided that we wanted to rebrand and turn it to more of a utility for more types of small businesses. So not just flower shops, but really try to help all the people that were going through this issue of not being able to, you know, have their customers go online. They weren't able to walk into their shops, obviously because of the shutdowns. And so for us, it was doubling down on our mission to help these small businesses. So we rebranded a Promenade and added some more types of industries that we're gonna help out.
Awesome.
So we have a few more brands now. So Promenade's the corporate brand, and then we have Bloom Nation for flower shops. We have Swig for retail liquor stores and wine shops. Dig In is for pizzerias, and Bev is for breweries.
Love it. All right, so then let's go back 9 or 10 years, and we'll start there. Where did the idea and how did the original company come about?
Yeah, so I was actually an investment banker out of school. So I went to Berkeley, graduated with an economics degree, and jumped right into corporate finance. That was the quickest way to make a lot of money, not having a master's degree, was to go into investment banking. So I went into mergers and acquisition advisory work, and I was helping tech companies, whether it was a merger or valuation or acquisition. And there just happened to be a flower company that was being sold as one of our clients. And in these deals, you have to learn a lot about the industry and the competitive landscape really quickly. That's when I discovered there was a big problem in this industry. And I happened to have an aunt that was a florist that I started asking her about what's happening on the local level. So I was seeing what's happening on the corporate side, started spending time on the local side with my aunt to really understand the dynamics of the industry. And quickly realized there was a huge problem with these brokers. They were just eating up all the, you know, demand from the consumers, selling off the orders and the demand to the local businesses at a high commission, and providing a really unrealistic expectations for both the customer and the florist, where you would see these amazing arrangements for $39.99. And, you know, by the time it got to the florist, as my aunt was telling me, there's no way to make money on these orders. They would have to either cut corners or do, you know, put in older flowers, or they would lose money if they did it the right way. So I realized there was a problem. And as I mentioned, I went to Berkeley. So I felt like half of my soul was good. You know, at Berkeley, you learn to hug trees and try to save the world and solve global problems. And then I went into finance, which I felt like I was kind of that corporate, you know, asshole. If I don't know if I'm allowed to say asshole,
sure, on
the podcast, but I felt like I was split between these two personalities, and I wasn't really fulfilled when I was doing in finance, because you're just moving around money and valuations for big corporations and investors. And so I thought, if there's one time to really go and help small folks like my aunt, she was really struggling. She started opening up about her problems in the industry and her shop. And I said, look, I feel like I could solve this. So I was arrogant and naive enough to think I could at the time. And no wife, no kids, no mortgage, no like real risk, no opportunity cost. So I ended up quitting my job and starting an idea that would ultimately help change the way the floral industry works today.
Wow.
And I thought, if it didn't work out, I was like, I'll go back in my MBA and just jump back into the corporate world. So it was the right time at the, you know, right place, right time. And I ended up leaving and starting Bloom Nation with two other friends of mine that we grew up together. Greg Weistein, who's still at the company today, and David Danishgar, who recently left a couple years ago, but the three of us built the company together.
Amazing. I want to ask a little bit more around the decision to jump into this and what the solution was. But before that, you mentioned the two halves of you, which I think is poetic and hilarious. but it reminds me of actually out of the, you know, out of my faith tradition in the Bible, there's this verse where it talks about being as shrewd as a serpent, but innocent as a dove. Mm-hmm. And for years, that made no sense to me. I'm like, what a weird freaking saying, like a lot of things in the Bible, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the older I got, I realized, like, actually, that's kind of what you're talking about, where our heart is needing to be pure, needing to be, like, you know, generous, compassionate, seeking for others' good. Yet to do that, you often have to have a mental sharpness, you know, and sometimes a shrewdness without crossing into dark, you know what I mean? And yeah. I feel like you have that good balance of like, no, I got the right heart, but I also have like actual skills to build businesses and solve problems that have come together.
Yes. So I feel blessed that I went into investment banking. It taught me a lot about work ethic, how to really think about strategic, you know, corporate initiatives and decision-making around how to take the company in a certain direction. But applying it to something that for me just feels really good is because we're helping small business owners that are owner operated. So these aren't, you know, we're not building software for Fortune 500 company. We're helping individuals get their business online and in front of their customers. So that extra revenue that comes through their, you know, through their business is, you know, they're putting more money in their pocket. They're hiring a new delivery driver. They're buying a new van. They're eating at the local restaurant down the street or the coffee shop. And for me, the most powerful stories are when people tell us like, hey, I was, you know, we had an event and this woman came to me who was part of our platform for Bloom Nation and said, my store was about to shut down and I discovered Bloom Nation. And not only did I turn it around, now I make enough money that I can save for my son's college education. I'm putting money on the side for his education. That's what makes me happy. Forget the revenue that we're doing or the KPIs that we're hitting or the VC validations that we have. I honestly, nothing matters more than hearing that story of this single mom saying that her life changed because of what we're doing. And not only that, her son's life hopefully will also change where he won't have a difficult time paying for school. You know, he'll have less debt going through school. That's the cool thing about what we do. And I'm so happy that I left, although very lucrative to work in investment banking, can make a lot of money. Not paying myself for years and years and years to get to this point was worth every moment for me. So it's a powerful story for us.
Absolutely. Now, the actual problem, if we look at this like as a business case, the problem is pretty clear. There's that middleman who's bringing all the customers to the local floor shop, but eating up any margin, overpromising things that they can't deliver and make any money. How hard was it to actually develop the solution that worked, that it sounds like was to replace the need to depend on those kind of big middle people and get the customers directly through their doors?
Initially, I mean, we didn't even see it as a big challenge. Again, out of being naive to us, like everything seemed like a simple solution. And that sometimes when you know too much, you can convince yourself not to do it.
Yeah.
So we got lucky because we didn't know the mountain we were needing to climb. It just looked like a hill. And then we go into that hill and then it's another hill. And then you realize, wow, that was a pretty epic mountain that we're climbing up right now.
Yeah.
In the beginning, it's really around solving like very, very core problems and not getting overwhelmed with trying to do too much at once. So when we first started the company, it was really in the idea like, can we even get small business owners to care about this problem? Do they care about this problem? Because we might care about the problem, and if they don't, then game over. So right. It was first and foremost trying to understand like, is this something that you guys want to solve? And it was a resounding yes. They were tired, especially in the floral industry, they were tired of dealing with like 1-800-Flowers and Teleflora, you know, telling them what to do, charging high commissions. They had no retention of their own customers. It was just a very, very one-way street. And even in building Promenade with the liquor stores dealing with Drizzly, food, you know, our pizzerias dealing with, you know, Postmates and Uber Eats, these big tech companies were really like controlling their destiny. And if, you know, one day they decided like, hey, we're going to put orders to this other restaurant, or we're going to make you pay more, they had no control. They were kind of at the will and mercy of these big aggregators. So we came in as an outlet to say, hey, here's some software that is just as elegant and convenient for customers as these big tech companies, but you can use it on an independent level. You can be your own, Grubhub for your own website that you can order and have it delivered the same way, except they're ordering directly with you, and you build your own customer base, your own loyalty. So the idea was really like, do people care enough to even solve this problem? Was probably the big question mark in the early days.
How do you get people to start using your software, like me as the consumer, using the local pizzas software or florist instead of going to 1-800-Flowers or Uber Eats?
Yeah, so it would happen a couple ways. With flowers, for example, a lot of people are actually already searching for local florists. They've learned enough over time that a better way to order flowers is to just search on Google, local flower shop Santa Monica. And you would then immediately see all the local florists results, because Google wants to promote local businesses. They're actually not pushing for these big tech companies or aggregators. So you'd fall on a local flower shop and we would just be powering their site. So you wouldn't necessarily, outside of knowing the bloomnation.com brand, which we have a marketplace, as a consumer, you can shop directly with all our florists in one place. But even if you were to fall onto an independent florist website, we would be powering it, sort of like Shopify, if you will. We would be the technology that they're leveraging. And same thing with a pizzeria and a liquor store. If you made any sort of searches online for a local business, you would fall onto their site. We would be powering it. And the other way is the restaurant owner or the liquor store owner is then promoting any new customer, whether it comes from Postmates or wherever, to then shop direct. So there's an offline component too, where they're telling their customers that you can now, order directly from our site. And that's their, another angle where you can convert an offline customer into an online one.
This next question is probably hard to quantify, but do you have a general idea of how long it took from starting the company to the place where you felt like you were out of the danger zone of it being a good idea that wasn't going to work?
I don't think I'm even there yet today. It's like 10 years in. You just don't know, because the world changes so quickly in competitive landscape. And, I'm sure Blockbuster thought that they weren't in the danger zone, right? Like there are companies that have been around forever that they foolishly thought that they weren't in the danger zone, and they're gone. I think that's something that I don't practice, is feeling comfortable, because then you're in a really bad place where you can get lazy about innovation. You can, think you're okay and then not make any risky bets anymore. And that could be risky in itself. So for me, this weekend, I was kind of in my head thinking like, we got to do more. This is not solving enough. Like, what else can we do? What's the next move? And it's an important thing to have, for sure.
For sure. Now, you're answering the macro question, which is great, because like I said, it's hard to quantify. Macro, maybe we're never out of the danger zone, right? Yeah. But if we do look statistically, you've already survived where a lot of ships go to crash, right?
Yeah.
Which is the initial 2 years-ish of getting off the ground. Can this actually pay me? Could it actually serve a customer? Do we even have demand? What were those first early years like when you're just proving the concept and just trying to get your first customers and figure out if this thing can make any money?
So it was a lot of, obviously, the founders doing everything and understanding and building relationships. So we're lucky enough where we were dealing with small business owners, which meant there was a lot of people behind that. It wasn't, we weren't selling software to Fortune 500 companies.
Yeah.
The relationships that we built and the conversations that we had were gold, because just sitting and listening, I think with SaaS companies, you kind of get your answer of what to build on a silver platter if you just listen. If it's a consumer, if you're trying to build some social app or something like that, then you got to make some bets and you kind of don't know until, you see what happens. But with business tools, listening is like such a powerful tool for you.
Yeah.
Where you can understand what they're asking for. And not to say every time that they ask for something, that's ultimately what they want. Because there's a lot of examples where they'll say, you know, well, we need something to do X, Y, Z. And if you just go explicitly and do that, you might not be solving the root problem. But if you do listen and try to pare down what they're saying and what they're asking for into solutions, it's really, really easy to build something that they inevitably will want or leverage.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of a good friend of mine is kind of he's been very successful in the SaaS industry, says the same thing. His name's Dane Maxwell, where he says, man, your customers, if you listen well, will tell you what they want. And he has like even four questions that he always asks that kind of leads him to a certain idea. And I'm curious for you, were there any questions that you found to be particularly helpful when you were first meeting with these local florists and things that you found like, man, that's the right question to ask them?
What became the reason why we started the company, even before we officially decided to start, and we were just going out talking to flower shops, the one common question and common answer was around their frustrations with the current system. Hmm. And the system meaning like the way FTD and 1-800-Flowers and Teleflora operated. And understanding that they were artists, like, don't you want to showcase your own work and your own designs? That sparked something that I would never have thought, because you don't start a flower shop because it's the most lucrative job in the world. You do it because you're an artist and you love flowers and you want to make people happy.
Yeah.
And they were stripping that away because they were commoditizing the industry. They were saying, make these like, you know, stock arrangements that are Photoshopped perfectly, do this exact thing over and over again. So they're feeling like fulfillment centers. Mm. And so when we asked this question, it sparked such an emotional reaction around, that it made it so obvious for us that we needed to start this company and do something different. And it became more about how do we put them in the spotlight? How do we make the florists feel like they're artists again and get them back to their craft? These people are, you know, small business owners. It's about the craft.
Yeah.
And whether, again, if it's a liquor store owner that knows everything about all the whiskeys in their shop, or it's the pizzeria that, you know, flies in their ingredients from Italy. It's all about their craft. And we want to be able to, you know, allow them to showcase that and stay independent and stay unique in a world that's kind of trying to commoditize everything into a systematic process. And that question really sparked us with a lot of emotion and made us want to start the company.
Yeah, it's a critical insight. That is huge when you have the aha that we're not just talking to fulfillment center here, we're talking to people that are artists, and therefore it leads to a whole different series of challenges and desires that they want versus just, I want to run the shop and I want to fulfill as many orders as possible. That's a totally different business.
Right.
And even as a consumer, I'm thinking, you know, in the last year or so, I've gotten more into like bourbons and wanting to mm-hmm. learn more about them and just right. enjoying them. And there's one place that I go to, even though there's 6-7 places near me I could go to, because when I go in there, the people seem genuinely passionate about it and will actually have a conversation with me
right.
about, hey, have you tried this? What did you think of that? All right, if you like that, you're going to like this, you know? Yeah. Exactly. And I'm like, I'd rather go there to the person that's excited to teach me about it and whatever and give them my business than just to a local shop that, hey, man, just grab a bottle of Jack. That's all you're yeah. looking for, you know?
Yeah.
So it sounds like you guys are providing a similar opportunity for them to connect with customers in that way and differentiate themselves.
Yeah. And do it online so that you still get that, you're still getting that curation online and able to experience. If you can't walk into the store, at least you're getting access to unique items or an interesting curation of items, whether it's a liquor store or a flower shop with the designs. It's allowing the experience to still feel personal, even if you do need to order online and you can't walk into the store.
Yeah. Well, let's fast forward a little bit because I'm so curious around this rebrand, and especially knowing that it hasn't just been one rebrand, but you guys have several different brands now.
Yeah.
What sparked that? And then just tell me what that's been like. I mean, that feels like a serious undertaking.
Yeah, it's funny because when we were rebranding, I didn't appreciate, or maybe I forgot how easy it was when we first decided with Bloom Nation. I was at home, I was with my mom, deciding on names. I was looking up domain names and Bloom Nation was available. I used a coupon code on GoDaddy and bought it for $1.99. And, you know, going through a rebrand 10 years later, just the legality of names and domain, like forget about even getting a domain name. And it's like, you know, these domains now are hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it was, I didn't even appreciate how easy it was back then. But that aside, the spirit of why we changed to a promenade was during the pandemic, noticing that our flower shops were actually doing quite well, because as people were stuck at home and they were, you know, missing a lot of events, birthdays, weddings, all these things, they resorted to flowers as a way to express their feelings thoughts. So all of a sudden, flower shops were thriving from a business sense, thriving and getting a lot of orders. And they were well prepared because of our technology. They were able to just scale up and start helping people share those sentiments online as they ordered online. But we noticed that a lot of these other businesses, they didn't have the same way to go online, and they were just getting all their demand coming from aggregators at that point. Cause you were ordering food through Postmates or Grubhub or whatever it is, and you couldn't walk into a restaurant. So imagine almost 100% of your revenue now was coming through these aggregators as a restaurant owner, and you're paying 20-30% commission. Even your own customers that would walk in and that you earn through, you know, you earn their loyalty through all your hard work of service and great food are now going on the apps and you're paying a commission on your own customer. And that was the moment I'm like, that is just not fair. You know, That's not right. That's not fair. That's when we decided, hey, these other industries don't have the same kind of technology investment as floral industry. We've solved something really interesting for floral. We can apply those same things that we made for the floral industry into these other categories. And we decided we're gonna make this part of our mission and become a multi-vertical software platform, but not make it generic where it's like, here's Shopify, go build, you know, set it up, you figure out how to make it work. We said, no, we're gonna create individual brands for each one. We're gonna keep Bloom Nation being floral, and we're going to bring up new brands so that each category lives and breathes in that industry and it's tailored and ready to go out of the box specific for that industry. You don't have to figure out how to make it work. And that was the idea around, let's create a corporate identity promenade and then have sub brands for each industry that we get into. So that's where Bloom Nation stayed as the floral industry software. We have Swig for our retail and liquor stores. Retail liquor stores and wine shops, and Dig In for pizzerias, and Bev for breweries. So that's how the structure is going to be. And as we enter new industries, we'll create new brands. But it's really to show that to the small business owner that this is not generic software. It's specifically catered to their category.
Yeah. Oh man, that's amazing. So this is kind of technical, but did you have to split current resources to be able to put the work into that, or did you have to add new resources, whether it be people or capital or things to be able to take on this?
So in the beginning, it's always split and, you know, wear more hats and, you know, figure out until you prove that it makes sense. Cause even when we first did this, we went into one industry and we couldn't just say all of a sudden, hey, we're going all in on it. I typically, historically, I would say Bloom Nation was very much like, you know, make small tests. And if it works, then double down and invest more. So even this strategy around rebranding came with a small test of like, okay, let's see if pizza shop owners care enough about breaking away from Postmates and Uber Eats. Like, do they want their own outlet? So it was very much a shared thing. We had one sales rep that was selling on Bloom Nation start calling on pizza shops and just striking up interest without really even building anything yet to see if we could do it. Mm. And it started that way. And eventually now we ended up raising more capital from venture firms in order to actually, you know, create silos and swim lanes of resources, both people and capital, so that they, you know, ultimately to run independently in a kind of product vision or resource way. So you're not needing to butt heads with anyone else in another brand.
I love that. Yeah, it reminds me of kind of the lean startup method of having a hypothesis, testing the hypothesis, getting the data, going back through there. When you could use a specific example or just general, but when do you know you have something? Like, is there a certain amount of interest you're gauging, a percentage, or like, how do you know you have something?
We use BloomNation as the, because it, we were working on it for so long, we use that as like the our gold standard, I guess, of if you can get the metrics to look similar to what we've been doing for the last 10 years, then you probably have something. So when we were calling on pizza shops and liquor stores, the goal was like, can we get enough interest at the same rate? Or, you know, if you, you look at the sales funnel, are the conversations converting into opportunities the same way as they were with BloomNation? And that would be our indicator that this makes sense. This is something that we should really invest in. And lastly, I would say, are we actually helping them out? Like, do they feel like once they are using it, like, yeah, this is working on a kind of like a qualitative level. If the pizza shop owner was like, wow, they were happy. They enjoyed it and they were excited about it. That was also an indicator for us.
Got it. What's been the biggest learning lesson going from a business that had operated in one vertical to now operating in multiple verticals?
No matter how much you plan or think about, you know, everything, there's inevitably going to be something thrown into the mix or a wrench thrown into your plans. And if you are too rigid about it and you feel like it has to work exactly how you thought of it, then you shouldn't even start. So for me, that was the big takeaway, was you got to be more fluid and thinking about all the things that could eventually happen and just be okay with it, because you got to have a North Star. And if you're still headed toward the North Star, even though things can go left or right, up, back, up and down, that should keep you going.
Mm. Yeah. You seem to have a good calibration on comfort and discomfort. You mentioned earlier, you don't like to get too comfortable because you don't want to get lazy.
Yeah.
My curiosity was, well, how do you not stay so uncomfortable that you are miserable, right? And it sounds like you've got just more of an open-handed approach where there is a level of comfort, of peace, of, you know, confidence, but there's also a level of flexibility that things may change and that's okay. Am I right on that?
Yeah. I mean, it's, I want to say over time, you it's something that I've learned, and I wasn't like that way originally. I've built a lot more thick skin. I've learned to manage the emotional roller coaster of starting a company, because in the early days, you get VC funding, you think you're on top of the world, and then you're running out of cash, and then you feel like, you know, game over. And it's really easy to ride that ride and try to feel everything. It feels good. And over time, you just have to really allow yourself to ultimately realize that at the end of the day, hopefully it works out, but there's going to be ups and downs, right? And to take a little bit of celebration when things are going well, and when things go bad, kind of just, you know, tackle it and feel like tomorrow's another day.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, that's something that takes time. It wasn't built inside of me originally. It just, you know, over the course of time, things happening, and I've just taught myself to keep an even keel across all the challenges, because every day is different. Every time there's going to be something good or bad that happens. And if you're constantly feeling that, the mental resilience required is almost impossible to make it through. So you have to kind of ease things, you know, over the course of time.
Absolutely. And that's what I was thinking early on. I was like, all right, we got one gutter on this side of being too relaxed. But then we have the other gutter. I mean, there was people I was interviewing early on the podcast that were recounting in their early days. One person was starting to go blind because of stress.
Yeah.
Another person had a back injury that lasted over a year because of stress. Yeah. And they're like, man, that was the other gutter. It was like taking it on too much and being in survival mode all the time and not learning how to find that good even keel middle ground, you know?
Yeah. I'll tell you, our third co-founder, David, he was a professional poker player, and I probably learned a lot from him, because in a game of poker, you might have the best hand to start and you can lose everything, or you might have a bad hand and kind of things will play out as each hand goes out. He's a Texas Hold'em player. And that was a kind of a lesson I took away from that in poker, was that you just don't know yet. So you got to just ride it out. You know, something bad could happen, but it ultimately could end up being a great thing. I mean, there was a moment where we were running out of money and I thought, you know, this is it. You know, we had a really tough time raising more capital, but it ended up being the best thing for us. Thankfully we survived, but it ended up allowing us to understand, well, where are we putting our money? Where are we putting our resources?
Yeah.
You know, money covers up a lot of problems. You know, if you have too much capital, you just throw money at things and you don't realize what's working, what's not working. And you can get really caught up in just feeling like everything is moving in the right direction from the force of just capital infusion. But when you're running out of money, you quickly say, well, this is not providing value. And this person's not doing what they need to do. And it gets rid of all the noise. And at the time you think, man, we're running out of money. It's stressful. It's horrible. It's that. But I want to say, looking back from that point on to today, we probably learned the most about our business. And so, you know, you got to just understand that these are just the hands still being dealt. And until it's, you know, it's over in a good or bad way, you still got a shot, you know?
Yeah, man, poker. I've not thought about that before, but what a great analogy of how to better play the game. Like, if you get too excited because you won a big hand, you can make a mistake. You can get overconfident or you can get overcautious,
yeah,
where you're trying to protect the big win that you just got.
Yeah.
And the vice versa. If you got, man, the river card, even though all the odds were with you,
yeah,
just totally blew you up. You can have a meltdown and then you're out of it, you know? And I got friends who are in hedge funds right now, leading their own hedge funds, and they were talking about the same thing. Like, the biggest killer, whether it be all the way down to day trading, all the way up to, you know, big hedge funds, is the emotional part. That if you get too high on the highs or too low, yeah, on the lows, like, you've got to stick to the game plan. Like, whatever the game plan is, you got to stick to that. Like, cut your losses when you should cut your losses and be risky when you feel like the math is in your favor to be risky, and you can't let the emotions start to change your plan. And I'm like, man, like, how do I want to take that in more as a business owner myself, you know?
It's the, I would say, you know, people often ask, especially we have new employees start and I have meetings with them. They say, what's the hardest part about your job? And they say, it's the mental fluctuations of whether it's within a day or the years. And it's handling that, because everything else is, you know, you just tackle the issue and you go through it, but it's the ups and downs that if you don't ride them well, you can easily give up. That's the, probably the number one culprit to people, you know, giving up, is the emotional aspect of it or the mental aspect of it.
Yep. Yeah. My amazing therapist, Dr. Mike, helped me see that a while back, where he said, hey, you're too much fluctuation. He's like, there's too much fluctuation in your emotions. And I was like, well, what's that from? And I love it. He cut to the chase, said, you got a weak mindset. I was like, what? He said, you got a weak mindset right now. Like, you haven't built what you talked about you built for you. You haven't built an internal frame, like a framework, that lets you know what to do when things are going well and lets you also know what to do when things are not going well and keep you a little more even keeled. And it was the perfect, perfect kick in the nuts, mm-hmm, for me to, okay, say, you're right. That's what this is. Yeah. I need to develop a stronger kind of mental framework that'll allow me to handle the pressure better. The pressure's not the problem. The ups and the downs are not the problem. It's how I'm relating to them.
Exactly.
Right? Well, I'm curious for you, what size is the team right now that you all have handling all this different verticals?
Yeah. So we were pretty sleepy in terms of like headcount growth. I would say a couple years ago, we were hovering around 30, 40, maybe 50 people. And in the last year, we grew exponentially. So we're closer to about 120, 130 employees now.
Wow.
We hired a lot over the last, you know, 18 months. And that's a whole new challenge. Going in every stage of the business, like going from a few co-founders to then 10 people, that changes the company. And then you go from 10 to maybe like 25, 30, that changes the company. And then we were at 50 for a good amount of time. But getting over 100, all the things that you thought made sense to you no longer make any sense. Like,
yeah,
it's just completely different in so many ways. And you have to change, you have to take all your constants and turn them back into variables and figure it all out from scratch. And having that many employees in a remote environment on top of that, the whole work from home thing has added a whole new layer of challenges and, you know, sometimes opportunities. It's not just all challenges. There's been a lot of benefits too. But yeah, and then we're now past the mental mark of over 100 employees. I think we're going to be at, you know, roughly 130.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's growing.
What were some of the big, whether it be mindset changes or even just maybe system and process changes? What were some of the big changes that you noticed were necessary going from a 30 to 50 company to now over 100?
Two things. One, it's the communication aspect is probably to me the biggest issue as you grow. You're no longer in the same room. You don't have this like osmosis because people are just talking around you. Again, remote environment made that even worse, but communicate, the way you communicate needs to change as you get bigger. And you no longer have like these personal relationships with people that are doing things for your company. You know, I used to be the one, you know, making some product decisions along with the product manager. Now I have a conversation with our VP of product every week, and they're the ones that are communicating. So even the way I am as a person had to change, where I'm no longer like the idea person. I used to be like, oh, I come up with ideas and I execute on them. But now it's like I need to empower people. I need to make them feel like they can come up with decisions and be impactful to the business and solve problems for them. That's changed a lot. And that's one aspect of it. And the second part is really around like systematic hiring and HR and people ops and that, because you're now, you have like a small town. So there are things that happen in a small town that are going to happen here in a company. And you have to be prepared to deal with those things, good and bad. And having investment in people ops and HR is another thing that can't be underestimated. It's inevitably part of the growth path.
And has there been any particular investment inside of the people side of it? I got a small town now. I need to take this more intentionally or whatever that you found to be particularly effective?
You mean outside of like even in like the technology or anything like that?
Anything. I love that idea of I've got a small town now. And so small town things happen, you know?
So I'd say like the place that I'm investing the most is I strip it away from any technology. I think it's about being human. So to me, outside of people ops, it's also just like the culture you're trying to build. And culture is not like the ping pong table and the snacks and stuff. That's just perks.
Those are perks.
But culture is putting like a soul into your business. Like who are you? And that can get lost too. So, you know, making sure that you are always reinforcing your culture and who you want to be and how you hire and incorporating that in your process of adding new people, the way you onboard them, the things that you out the gate explain to them what's important to you is also a big factor as you grow, because it can become very easy for it to change completely the dynamics of the whole organization as you grow. And then that core team that when they first started, everyone was on the same page and believed the same things and were here for the same reasons. All of a sudden now when you have 100 plus people, you have bad actors sometimes, or you'll have somebody who doesn't care at all and just looking for a job. And then you have somebody who's, you know, overly eager about it so there's just a mixed bag and you have to make sure that you really hone in on that culture and what their expectations are.
Yeah. What are some of the things that are most critical to your culture that you want to preserve, you want to promote?
The importance that we're only here to help our partners. And by partners are these small business owners. Nothing else should matter ultimately, because if you're not solving that, then you are just kind of covering up and creating a facade scenario. And I don't like to hire people that are overly corporate, where they know how to play the game. Yeah. They can create really great presentations and, you know, work the numbers to make them look more, you know, appealing. Because at the end of the day, are we either helping people or not helping people? You know, is that woman coming to us and saying she's saving money for her son's education or not? You know, those are KPIs to me, not this number that you can sort of manipulate and make it look better. So the culture and the thing that I really hone in on is about everyone having that sort of mentality that they're not here to further their own career on paper. They're here to be part of a movement that's going to help these small business owners not only survive, but thrive. And to me, that's the biggest resume booster. And I try to tell people that if you're coming here to talk about how many direct reports you had and your title and this, that, this is probably not the place for you. But if you want to make a change, if you want to make impact, and you want to be part of that impact and that, you know, building our getting, you know, accomplishing our mission, then this is a great place for you. So that's, to me, that's the culture, is like, do we all believe in that?
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. It makes me think of, similar to our business, one of our key strategic filters is income that comes from impact. So it's not, I don't ever want to separate those. If I feel like we're making a lot of income, but we're not really making a great impact, we're failing our mission.
Yes.
And vice versa, if we're making a big impact and no one's making any money, when we're just a charity, you know?
Yeah.
So we need working fairly together.
Yeah.
But the mission is the impact. Like, what is the problem we're solving? Who are the people we're helping? And one of the things that's been challenging to me, and I'm curious for you, is I know philosophically the best way to make an impact is to look more outward and less inward. You know, when I there's a book called Stephen Kotler wrote it. He had Rise of Superman. This one, I can't remember what this one was called. Stealing Fire.
Oh, yes, I read that book. Yeah.
So when he was talking about the Navy SEALs and how they got into that flow state, right?
Yes.
He talked about part of it was merging with the team, meaning like somewhat losing self protection and over concern about me, but instead like being a part of this unit and we're all working together. But what I found is often, as I try to encourage team members or whatever in that, they're like, "So you're telling me I can't be concerned about my own goals or my own whatever?" And I'm like, "No." No, but, you know, it's an interesting, like,
dynamic,
communication.
Yeah,
and a dynamic of, like, I'm not saying we don't care about the individual or your needs, but we want to put it in context of creating a place where you could feel like you're safe enough to care about the mission and knowing that you'll be taken care of as well. Right. Have you run into any of that kind of interesting dynamic of trying to promote one without the error of the other, I guess?
Yeah, it's a constant battle because I think in that, like, people naturally will feel a way about like, well, what does this mean for me? And how do I get myself where I need to be? And it is difficult to let go of that for the bigger, you know, cause of like the company, even though there's, I think, a bigger impact and a bigger gain to receive by doing that. It is not easy as someone who's maybe starting out of school, or maybe their first job, or they worked in another environment that wasn't like that, and they're coming here. It's not easy to buy into it. So you do have to do a lot more, I don't want to say selling, that's not the right word, but you have to communicate more about the importance of it and how valuable it can be, so that people, you know, eventually decide either this is the place or not. And it's okay if it's not.
Yes.
You know, I never have hard feelings. And I used to. Another thing is, when I was early days of the company, anytime anyone would quit or anything, I'd take personal offense to them when I leave the company. But now I've gone to the point where I'm like, if this is not for you, it's not a big deal. They're, you know, it's like a relationship, right? Like, mm-hmm. You're just not meant to be in this organization. I'll help you go to the right place. But we need people that all believe in this. So,
yeah, that's it, man. I think it is that figuring out and people feeling the permission to, like, well, first figure out if this is the right mission. Is this the right place? You know, if those things are taken care of, then the rest, if this is the right place and the pay is what you need it to be and the opportunity to grow and your skills is there, the rest is just overcoming that innate instinct to always be self-protective and instead give, like, buy in, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, someone, I've struggled with anxiety for a good bit of my life, and it was hard for me to wake up to a few years ago. A lot of it is centered around self-protection.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds kind of obvious to someone who doesn't struggle with anxiety, but to me, I was like, oh, so the opposite isn't peace. The opposite is not taking care of myself. It's knowing I actually am fine, and so therefore I can actually use all that energy to better love and serve people, and that's when I don't feel anxiety. Mm-hmm. If I'm focused on you, Forbode, instead of focused on me, I don't have any anxiety.
Right.
I just feel like excited. We're having a good conversation. It's only when my focus turns too much, like, am I okay? Is this situation going to be okay? Is this going to work out? Mm-hmm. And I just realized it was even if I wanted to protect myself, it was counterproductive. It was actually not serving me to be that self-focused. Mm-hmm. It actually better served me to be others focused, you know?
That's powerful. And that discovery.
Huge. But it's hard because it's an instinct we all have, depending on what our trigger is or what our insecurity is. It's hard to help people recognize that without feeling like you're trying to manipulate them to just give more to the business. You know, I'm like, no, I'm telling you, that self-protection is killing you right now, unless you're in a place that actually isn't right for you, or in a place, a relationship that's dangerous. Well, then, yeah, you should be listening to that and you should move on to somewhere else. But if you're in a good place that you love, you believe in, you're probably shooting yourself in the foot not to just give your best and serve the mission of the company, right?
Agreed.
I love it. The other part you mentioned, if you can ever help me with this, I would love it. My friend Dane said this as well, that his business got so much healthier and better when he took things less personally. And I am still working on that. Still working on taking it less personally. If it doesn't work out for someone, or if a customer is unhappy and that kind of thing, I'm like, man, my personality is a feeler. And I'm like, I've got to figure out how to not callous my heart, but to take it a little less personally.
Yeah, that's really tough, but it is it's a critical part of, you know, growing an organization. And I still, not to say I'm 100%, I still take things, you know, personally, especially when it comes to like competitors or other corporations, or, you know, kind of, you know, causing issues. But at least what I've gotten to walk away from my personal, you know, feelings was like people just deciding that this isn't a place for them to work. And I used to take it personally, and now I don't, but it takes time. Yeah. It's not an easy thing to do.
Absolutely. Well, maybe you can help me as the years go on. All right. So let's jump into our lightning round questions, and I'll let you get back to your day. Great. So question number one, if you could ingrain one message into your entire organization, what would that be?
To remain human, I think, is the biggest thing. Just, you know, I know there's policies, rules, procedures and stuff, but if it just doesn't make human sense, then, you know, it doesn't make sense for the company. So just stay human.
Love it. Number two, what is the single best advice you've ever gotten about growing your business? And also, what was the worst?
Best advice was to not take advice from people. And worst advice I got was that there's an exact recipe for success. Just do these things and your company will be successful. I think that's horrible. So I live by those two things right now. I try not to listen too much to what people say.
Cool. Number three, what causes you the most stress or worry currently leading your organization?
People, just making sure everyone, you know, that culture, the as we're growing as an organization, that we still keep that same soul and spirit of who we are today. I still, you know, that's the stuff I'm thinking about all weekend when I'm not at the office. It's part of my constant mindset right now, is the making sure the culture.
Totally makes sense. Question number four, what is your big audacious goal for this company? What's the big picture?
We become a utility for local business, not even small businesses. Again, it's not the Shopify to ship things. It's for local businesses to use this as a utility to serve their neighborhoods and communities. And if we can get into many, many, many categories and become the go-to software to empower them with that, then I think we've succeeded.
Totally. All right. Question number five. This is our kind of fun, creative question. We're going to play a game called Back to the Future. So let's imagine you got to get into a DeLorean and you get to go back to your past, but you're not there to necessarily change anything, but you do get to deliver a message. When would you go back in your past, and what message would you pass along to that younger version of yourself?
Well, outside of telling myself to buy Bitcoin, I would probably go to the days of early days in the company, and I would allow myself or tell myself that I should enjoy it more. Looking back today, you know, everyone wants to become bigger. Everyone wants to grow more and become successful. But the most fun times are during the early days of just like, you know, we're like a couple, you know, few guys in the office laughing, working hard, figuring things out. And you don't realize how amazing that is. If I could just tell myself and somehow convince myself that this is going to be the best time you're going to have in the history of the company, even when, you know, we have over 100 employees and you raised a ton of capital and you can consider yourself successful, it doesn't compare to those fun early days of being a scrappy little startup.
Yes. Come on. So good. Well, my friend, thank you so much for taking your time, sharing your story and your wisdom. This has been such a great and valuable conversation, and I really appreciate you being here.
Likewise. Thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
Founders, thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast and hop into our monthly founder email so we can ensure you stay on the edge of peak performance and massive business results.